Welcome to WMNF 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. This is the Tuesday Cafe. I'm Sean Canaan. Today we look at transportation, highways, and alternatives to roads. It's sure to be a lively conversation, so we're going to take your calls as well. 813-239-9663 is the number to call in to get in the queue. You can also email us at dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. My guests are advocates for smart transportation. Michelle Cookson is a board member and founder of the group Sunshine Citizens. And Josh Frank is an urban designer recognized for the plan called Boulevard Tampa. Welcome back to WMNF, Michelle and Josh.
Thanks, Sean.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. Good to be here.
I'm glad you could join us today. So let's begin with highways. Across the country and here in Tampa Bay, highways often cut right through and displace vibrant communities, especially communities of color. It's a story that's pretty well known. We're very familiar with the I-275 story here in Tampa, but it reminds us, but it was recently amplified, that is, by a lengthy story in the Los Angeles Times. So tell people about the history of I-275. Who wants to go for that one?
Yeah, so just to give a sort of brief overview, you know, I-275 was one of the earlier interstates in our area. It was built in the mid-50s to late, early 60s. And basically built on top of Central Avenue in Tampa. So for those of you who've been here for a long time may know, Central Park was essentially one of several Harlems of the South. It was known for its African-American business economy. It was known for the music scene, the jazz scene, the art scene, as well as essentially being a very healthy and vibrant community in Tampa. And the interstate was essentially built right through the heart of it. You know, there's a lot of debate as to the intent, you know, the racism that was directly behind it. And, you know, I've said you won't find a memo that says, hey, let's, you know, displace this community on purpose. But over a series of 50 years, this process has continually displaced those same communities over and over again. And I think that LA Times article speaks to that. It highlights a gentleman who's been displaced not once but twice by I-275. So, you know, it's a long history. And in fact, it's not just 275, it's I-4 through Ybor City, which impacted Latino communities, as well as, you know, Selman Expressway ran through Dobieville. So there's a long history of interstate construction, large highway construction, and even large road construction, and displacing minority communities, not just here, but in pretty much every city in the United States and in North America, too.
And yeah. In the Bay Area as well, on over to St. Pete, you know, when we talk about and try to bring attention to this topic, I don't know if everyone realizes, like, they think of other large metros in Florida, such as Miami or Orlando, where there's been a ton of damage done. But in the Tampa Bay region, it's 5 interstate highways that were purposely plowing over vibrant Black communities and people of color, and continues to this day. I mean, our organization was founded to help fight against the state, Florida Department of Transportation coming in and saying, hey, guess what? You're so lucky. Guess what you get? And at the time, it was a monstrous highway expansion that would continue that same pattern of destroying the heart of our city. You know, in St. Pete as well, there's local movements that are trying to remove those highways that have done the damage because they're spurs. They're not needed. They're not how they want to grow. And that's part of why we fight like we do. We know we can do better. We know there's a better way forward. But this pattern, we know the history, but we keep seeing it being repeated.
Well, that was Michelle Cookson, a board member and founder of the group Sunshine Citizens. We also heard Josh Frank, an urban designer recognized for the plan called Boulevard Tampa. You're listening to Tuesday Cafe with Sean Canaan on WMNF Tampa. And Michelle and Josh both mentioned St. Petersburg. And so we're familiar with, I think a lot of us are familiar with the story of the TROP and how the TROP displaced hundreds and hundreds of people in the Black community. But right adjacent to the TROP is Highway I-175. So is that part of when people talk about the Gaslight District being paved over, was 175 any part of that at all?
It was the gas plant neighborhood. And you're right, 175 was a part of that. You know, originally the plan for I-175 and 375 in St. Pete was to be a loop. And that loop was going to connect, I believe, through what's now MLK. So closer towards the waterfront. But that never ended up happening. And that's, you know, not uncommon for a lot of reasons where certain communities of color are impacted, but a project isn't fully realized because other communities have the means to fight it. So, for example, in St. Petersburg, you know, that connection between 175 and 375 never happened because of the privilege of those folks to, you know, not only have political clout because of their connectedness, but to have everything from the free time to campaign against it. It's something that the neighborhoods in the Gasplant neighborhood, Roser Park, some of those areas never had. And that is just one part of a larger movement of urban renewal, which, you know, not only was interstate construction, but removing, you know, neighborhoods, demolishing properties, demolishing buildings, and rerouting traffic through some of these neighborhoods. So it wasn't just the 60, 100, 200 feet between right-of-way lines for an interstate. It was, in some instances, an entire neighborhood in either direction, as is the case for the Trop. So Tropicana Field, in and of itself, is another example of some of that urban renewal process.
And we'll talk about more about Tampa in just a bit, but since we're on this question of St. Petersburg and I-175, there is a proposal out there. There's a lot of discussion about redeveloping the Trop area, especially if the Rays leave. And there's also a discussion about taking I-175 out and just completely making it at grade, part of the, you know, connecting the communities on either side, Roser Park with the rest of downtown St. Pete, I guess it would be. So what can you say about the possibility of I-175 going away?
Well, just really quickly, I actually worked on a very early version of that project, studying what the impacts could be. And so I'm very familiar with it. In fact, I was actually also born in St. Petersburg. So I know that area, you know, very, very intimately. It's something that, you know, there's two sides to it. You know, one is that obviously, you know, not having the interstate, reconnecting those two communities not only provides a safer environment to, you know, connect the thriving part of downtown to South St. Pete, which is for a long time not seen much in terms of, you know, improvements or investment, even though it's been a healthy, vibrant community. You know, so making that connection does make things safer, makes actually traffic better, which is an important topic we can talk about in a minute. But the other side of it is what we don't want to see is essentially an interstate being replaced with an at-grade version of the interstate, which is a really, you know, something that happens quite a bit. The Seattle example, the viaduct coming down, you know, they replaced that with a tunnel and a boulevard, which is fantastic. But the boulevard's still really high speed, unsafe, doesn't have enough crossings. So, you know, the end result is probably better. It's a net gain, but still it's not where we need to be in some of these alternatives that we need to have.
They've got to have public transit, like mass capacity, you know, high capacity mass transit. That's got to be in the mix.
So since you bring that up, how does that happen in Tampa, St. Petersburg, and the rest of the Bay Area? One of the criticisms you always hear is, well, we just don't have the density for that, so we can't do the type, like you can't have a metro like in D.C. or in Washington, I'm sorry, or in New York City, because it doesn't have the same density. But I'm sure you have responses to that.
Well, sure. I mean, we get this question all the time, and Josh can speak to Boulevard Tampa in greater detail, obviously. It's his vision. But it's so crazy to me. You always get like, where will the cars go? And I understand that because the built environment everyone sees, all they've ever been presented with is you have to get in a car to do something. You can do a project like Boulevard Tampa. The data that he has shows that spur of the interstate, meaning the 11 miles from the downtown interchange north to Bears, are local trips. So if you provide the people who live already in the center of the city, the most dense environment we have, another means of getting around, you know, it's possible, but you've got to start with the transit first. You have to start with connecting neighborhoods. You have to start with a mentality that looks at it from a human perspective, at the ground level where human beings are, whether they're walking on a bike, whether they have a wheelchair. You know, how do they get around? What do they need to do during their day? Do they have a child with them? Things that other cities do, it's always possible. I think we have to change our perspective, and we have to start with those questions first, and we have to start with the citizens who live here. I mean, another thing that FDOT always throws at us, those of us who are advocating for this vision, is, you know, always along the lines of like, well, what are we going to do? All these people are moving here. And that's our point. Well, if we're going to experience this growth, this is the moment. It's been the moment for 30 years, but here we are today. let's do something better. Let's start with the transit first. Let's start with a human-centric perspective first. And that's how we go forward. That's how we deal with growth. So if we're going to have that density anyways, why aren't you addressing it in this manner?
And I don't buy that argument that we don't have a dense enough population or for some reason our citizens are, you know, not open to taking transit. The city of Tampa and its transit facilities in the teens and 20s carried more people than today with a significantly less population.
Exactly.
So it's not that there's something inherently unique about our people that we just won't take transit. It's that it's just not available. And the transit that is available is often either disconnected, you can't walk to it because there's no sidewalks or there's no streetlights, or, you know, it doesn't go exactly where you need it to go. And so, you know, part of the Boulevard Tampa conversation is reframing that mindset around, you know, we've invested in essentially one mode of transportation, which is cars and roads, for the past almost century in this city and in this region. And in order to, you know, accommodate that growth in a smart way, in a way that doesn't, you know, it actually improves the city's budget and services, is something that, you know, we have to build around transit, because we simply cannot continue to do what we're doing now and expect different results. It just will not work.
That's Josh Frank, an urban designer recognized for the plan called Boulevard Tampa, which we've been talking about, but we'll get into a little bit more detail in just a bit. Also, Michelle Cookson is a board member and founder of the group Sunshine Citizens. You're listening to Tuesday Cafe with Sean Canaan on 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. It's 10:17 in the morning. So, we were talking about the what Tampa used to look like with as far as transportation. So remind people, this was maybe a century ago, so we're not familiar with this from firsthand experience. Tell us what Tampa looked like when, if you wanted to get around from, say, Seminole Heights or Tampa Heights, if you wanted to go downtown, you didn't have to drive.
That's right. So Tampa had a parallel sister city, sort of comparable level of transit to, say, New Orleans or Atlanta, or you know, some of these other southeast cities that grew up around the same era, which is essentially a streetcar era. So our streetcar network essentially covered everything from Ballast Point to Sulphur Springs. And at that time, city limits were essentially the river all the way down to Old Port Tampa. And essentially, you could get from Ballast Point to Sulphur Springs with changing trains, you know, once in the downtown area. It ran, I believe, 7 days a week, including Sundays, and really late into the evenings, even on weekends. And as I mentioned, carried more people in the teens and 20s than HART does today. And our population today is, you know, tenfold what it was in the teens and 20s. So that level of density in the urban core hasn't really changed. If anything, maybe it's gotten a little bit more dense over time with downtown developing, Water Street coming online, those sorts of things. But the core part of our city fabric still exists today. And the only thing missing is that streetcar network, which, you know, for those who may know their history, was essentially, no pun intended, railroaded by the auto industry, a big conglomerate that essentially bought up the lines, tore out the tracks, and burned the streetcars out in a field somewhere. So that happened in a lot of American cities. We're not unique in that aspect, but we are unique in that we haven't figured it out in the past 50 years, 60, 70 years since, and begin to make, you know, strides towards improving that. So other cities that have had their streetcars taken out have decided to reinvest in mass transit, whereas we're, I think, you know, we're on par with a Sheboygan, for example, even though we're one of the largest metros in the country.
And the there is a streetcar of sorts in downtown Tampa. What can you say about the Tampa streetcar, what its scope is, what its future is, and how that might play into all of this?
I love the streetcar.
I mean,
we both love the streetcar.
Yeah, take it all the time.
I rode it to my wedding, in fact. You know, one of the things, though, that hinders the streetcar, there's a couple of things, and I could get into a lot of detail. Maybe that's another show. But, you know, it's not necessarily a mode of mass transit the same way we would see a streetcar, a modern streetcar in, say, like Oklahoma City or you know, out in Phoenix or Glendale. It's a heritage streetcar, which essentially is made new to look old. So it's got issues with ADA accessibility because it's got stairs. It can only carry so many folks at a time. It doesn't have the capability of adding cars as a modern streetcar might be able to do. So there's a few things that sort of hinder it. But the bigger issue is that it really is a short segment that only connects two or three locations, right? Ybor Channel District and downtown. So the folks that you're engaging with the streetcar currently is pretty limited. The extension up into Tampa Heights all the way to Palm Avenue is fantastic. It's going to get folks closer to the streetcar than they've been in almost 100 years. It's a great, great improvement. My philosophy and my perspective is we need to do that 10 more times and bring back a system that's similar to what we had 100 years ago in order to actually do two things. One, move more people, and two, get cars off the road. When you create transit that's easy, walkable, and frequent and within close proximity to a lot of folks will use it. And so they'll use it instead of driving, which, you know, makes their life better, but also makes life better for the folks who do continue to drive, right? So those trips are now off the road, and we don't have to continually expand and repeat some of those same mistakes that we have, you know, in the past 50, 60 years.
Yeah, we need to massively expand the streetcar system. And there's a project in motion right now with the city of Tampa. We need to make certain, us, meaning those of us who live here in the city of Tampa, that we push our local officials to ensure that they are looking at that project and expanding it again in a way that is putting people first instead of capitulating to FDOT's requirements that the streetcar go second to any car traffic. I mean, that's the point of it. We need to get more cars off the road, and we need to make that accessible to folks. It'll be a modernized streetcar. It's going to replace the replica trolleys in the historic style. But it needs to expand beyond Tampa Heights, and we need to loop it around and connect Ybor City in. So again, we're going to get more dense. We see development happening in the urban core of the city. In the city, we should look at those kinds of expansions that can help with transit projects, as opposed to other things that we have to think about when we look at the rest of the county.
So what does it look like right now, the expansion of the streetcar? What's planned? What's the timetable? Where might it go?
My understanding is right now they're looking at getting federal funding as part of either the bipartisan infrastructure deal that just passed, some funding through that, potential grant through USDOT, or maybe even through part of the Build Back Better legislation that's being figured out right now. But the plan is where it currently stops, which is right about the Fort Brooke garage, the Franklin Street Esplanade there at One City Center prevents it from going up Franklin Street the rest of the way. So it's going to make a turn and go up Florida Avenue heading north all the way to Palm with several stops in between, go across Palm right in front of the YMCA that's right there in Tampa Heights, and then back down Tampa Street to Fort Brooke, essentially making a loop with Franklin Street in the middle, which is quite nice, actually. It makes Franklin Street a really fantastic future pedestrian corridor. And I know that there was a big downtown conference with folks from all around the country, and they led a Franklin Street visioning effort, and that was a lot of the conversation that happened there is, hey, this thing's going to be blanketed by streetcar, and, you know, it's only a few blocks from the Riverwalk. How can we make Franklin Street really great? But as Michelle mentioned, you know, that's something that has been in the works for a long time, but we still need, you know, to get into South Tampa and into Ybor City and into Sulphur Springs. And, you know, if we were to overlay a more advanced transit system in a different metro on top of our area, you know, we would have six or seven lines by now. And you mentioned the DC Metro. You know, the DC Metro was built, and it was initially a really big flop. It was a failure. It didn't really have a lot of ridership. There wasn't a lot of development around each station. But, you know, it takes time for that stuff to happen. And so 30 years from then, you know, even 50 years from then, we can see that the DC Metro is really become the heart of Washington, D.C.
And it's expanding. They've just recently opened two new lines.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah, I remember that. I have family in D.C. I remember that occurring and everybody complaining about it. And I've always loved that system. And when you go today, it's just amazing, the transit-oriented development that's come up around those stations to the point where now they are servicing suburban areas. And it originally was just in the middle of the city or the district.
And living near a metro stop is an advantage. If you own property there, or if you can rent there, then that makes getting to work easier.
Yeah, it's very prized.
Our guests are Michelle Cookson, a board member and founder of the group Sunshine Citizen, and Josh Frank, an urban designer recognized for the plan called Boulevard Tampa. My name is Sean Canaan. You're listening to Tuesday Cafe on WMNF Tampa 88.5 FM. It's 10:25 in the morning. If you'd like to call in, it's 813-239-9663. You can also email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. I have a ton of other questions, but we do have Robin on the line. So why don't we take a call from Robin? Hi, Robin in Sarasota. What would you like to say?
Hello. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, which had a very highly developed ferry boat system. And then they've replaced it with a trolley system that was very efficient. And as you mentioned, it was the automobile industry and the oil industry that wanted to tear up the public transit system and replace it with cars. You know, but before that, it was highly efficient. You know, you could get from, you know, Berkeley, where I grew up, to San Francisco in no time at all. The bottom of the Bay Bridge was all trolley cars. The top was a two-lane road for, you know, automobiles. But, you know, they had a very highly developed system and destroyed it. It's like, what? So,
well, Robin, thanks so much for sharing that. And let's see what our guests have to say about lessons that can be learned from that example.
Well, San Francisco is a great example. And, you know, Robin mentioned ferries, which is something, you know, it's a yes and around here. We need not just an expanded streetcar network, but ferries, I think, make a lot of sense. As well as buses and walking and biking. You know, some of the cheapest ways we can get folks to shift their mode of transit is to invest in trails and bike networks. So, you know, it's not just about the more expensive fixed guideway types of things. And those take even a longer time horizon. So if we wanted to act now and quickly, those are some of the lighter things we can do. But San Francisco is a great example because they are actually one of the cities that has successfully removed an interstate, the Embarcadero Freeway. They really were forced into that decision in a lot of ways because of the Loma Prieta earthquake that sort of, you know, damaged it. It was a double-decker, as Robin mentioned, similar to the Bay Bridge. But, you know, they had a choice, and they ultimately decided to replace it with a boulevard with a streetcar, which is essentially what the Boulevard Boulevard Tampa vision looks like. And it's been fantastic. It's been not only great for the waterfront in San Francisco, for those of you who've been there, the transit ridership is fantastic. The development around it is great. And you know, Sean, you mentioned, you know, living next to a metro station, it's not just great for the folks who live there. It's great for everything from leveraging that land value into affordable housing. It's great for leveraging that land value into sustainability and resiliency initiatives to, you know, providing broadband, new internet connections. Literally, the land becomes more valuable and the city has a greater say, or the agency has a greater say in what can be put on it. So when we design cities, when I design cities, we think of these things, and transit is not just necessarily about moving people. It's also about creating an armature or a spine on which your city can grow in a smart, resilient, sustainable way.
So how does that work when you say leverage the valuable real estate for affordable housing? That almost seems counterintuitive. So walk me through that.
So there's a lot of different ways that can be done. You know, whether it's a land trust or a land bank, where the agency, the city, is actually the owner of the land, acquiring it. Or it could also work through regulatory processes such as a overlay district, for example. The city of Tampa has several overlay districts. One is, let's just say, for example, is the North Franklin Street area north of the interstate. That's an overlay district. Essentially, that overlay gives the agency more rules that can be put in place for a developer to follow. So we know we've got a transit station. That land is really valuable. It's got a lot of people moving. It's got a lot of, commerce potentially happening, retail happening around it because of the sheer number of folks that are there. So we, as a city, are going to ask the developer to, you know, provide a percentage of affordable housing in order to exceed a minimum density level, for example, or a height limit, or to give the developer something to get that affordable housing. So creating an overlay district around a transit station is something that's done in almost every city around the country to then get that get the things a city wants out of a development that we know is going to happen around those stations.
It's a really important point. I don't know that folks realize this. I've learned a lot about it over the years. Like the interstate highway, you know, the work that the State Department of Transportation is trying to push through there and expanding it costs the city of Tampa a lot of money. We have all this fallow land. That's a big lie that somehow interstates boost the economy. They don't. They drain our local economy. We inherit all of the cost. We have to do the maintenance. We have to take care of the trash and cutting the grass and the lighting underneath these overpasses. Like, it's a drain on those of us who live in the city, and we get nothing out of it. And, you know, it's one of the things that really aggravates me is this mentality around Tampa just exists for people to run over us and go through us. Like, we are the economic powerhouse of this area, and we should take a stance that says no. Like, we are the leaders, and we're going to lead, and we're going to do this in a different manner. And interstates in a moonscape of concrete is not our future for so many reasons. Like Josh mentioned, you know, we are facing a crisis in terms of how the planet. Yeah, we're in climate change big time, and we have so many resiliency initiatives we need to do. And the way we're going to get there is not like expanding the interstate. It's crazy.
No, and you know, the converse of what I said is actually a really important point, because whereas transit can actually be used to leverage for development and for affordable housing, the interstate provides almost no economic return. From property taxes, that land is literally off of the tax books in perpetuity, so it generates less property tax. None, essentially. The other side of it is the property next to the interstate is depressed because of that interstate. So if you're looking at building townhouses on a property that a parcel that's right against the interstate, you're looking at a sound wall even, you know, your property value is going to be less than if you were to build a townhouse next to a road in a similar condition that wasn't an interstate. So, you know, the just from an economics standpoint, it's almost a no-brainer that these interstates are just major anchors, not only on a city's budget, but on the private sector and the capitalism, you know.
Versus if that became an at-grade boulevard that had a you know, mass transit system integrated into it, and now you've reconnected that neighborhood, that same townhouse development is worth, you know, infinitely more.
And it probably has street-level offices or retail.
And can be used to prevent displacement and other things that come from that development if the regulatory processes aren't in place. So by having transit, by leveraging that value, you are creating a framework that, you know, we can actually prevent some of these things that would happen in an otherwise, you know, vacuum environment for development.
Our guests are Josh Frank, an urban designer, and Michelle Cookson with Sunshine Citizen. You're listening to Tuesday Cafe with Sean Canaan on 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. This is WMNF in Tampa. I do have more people on the line, but let me read a couple of the texts that have come in. Rick from East Tampa writes in, we love the trolley. The old-fashioned look is a favorite. We imagine, just like in the old days of the Ybor cigar factories, having the on-site Cantor reader reading aloud to travelers, maybe chapters from the 1619 Project is what Rick in East Tampa is imagining. Also, Jeff says, how would the growth of mass transit, which might cause more crowding on a bus or a train, deal with the issue of social distancing due to the pandemic? So that's a good one to follow up with.
Yeah, you know, that's a new challenge for sure. Let me answer the first one actually real quickly. One of the things I think I neglected to mention is that the streetcar expansion is going to keep two of the actual legitimately vintage trolleys. So the Breezer car and the Bernie car, which I think the Bernie car is from the 20s or 30s, and the Breezer car is either a replica or an original from the late 1800s. So we will have a mix of vehicles, I believe, which is pretty cool. The second question, though, about social distancing, you know, I've seen a lot of research and studies that suggest that the you know, spreading of the virus on public transit is actually pretty minimal. It's akin to being on an airplane, for example. As long as folks are obviously, you know, keeping their distance, washing their hands, wearing, you know, a mask, you know, taking all the precautions that are required by the CDC. There are HEPA filters. The air is changed every 2 minutes, you know, similar to like an airplane. You know, I'm not a true expert on air quality standards, but, you know, I know that that's something that is generally pretty safe. And we see countries that definitely have overcrowding on public transit in Southeast Asia and Shanghai and Singapore and some of these other countries, and their infection rates are still pretty low. So I think it's something to be aware of for sure. But I can't say that it's going to be, you know, drastically different than an airplane.
And the during the pandemic, they were certainly enforcing the mask requirement. The front of the PSTA bus said, you know, no mask, no ride, or something like that. So, you know, the times I rode it, no one was questioning that you wear a mask.
Yeah, I just wear the bus and I just mask up and I'm vaccinated. So I don't feel any less safe.
Another question comes from Karen in Dunedin. She says, would love to see a connection from Pinellas and Hillsborough. I actually plan small trips to D.C., Chicago, Atlanta, and New York City because of the convenience of getting around. So what about that? It is super hard to get from Pinellas and in between Pinellas and Hillsborough County.
Yes, it is. It's why we built bridges. If you've known your history, you know, originally you had to drive around through Oldsmar all the way down to St. Petersburg. So, you know, that's a really great point, because most of what we've been talking about is sort of intercity transit, which is really what carries a lot of people daily and hourly. The regional level of transit is what carries people, you know, during commuting hours, you know, coming into Hillsborough County, going out of Hillsborough County for work or to get to the airport or to get to an event. And we need both. You know, connecting Hillsborough and Pinellas is a bit trickier because we have a big body of water between the two of us. So, you know, it's going to be more costly, more expensive, but it's something that, you know, has been needed to be done for a long time. Historically, it was done via ferry and, you know, via the small airplanes that, you know, used to cross between the two. But I think rail is a big part of that as well. And I would say even to South County through down to Sarasota, Manatee, and up to Pasco County and Newport Richey is something that we need to be thinking of. The CSX networks get talked about quite a bit for good reason. They literally connect all those places, and it's tracks ready to be used. So I would hope that, you know, that is something that gets looked at and is also part of a you can't have one without the other is what I'm trying to say. You have to have both.
Right, and we keep spending billions with a B of dollars on those same roadways and bridges that Josh mentioned. So if we have the money to invest in continuing to expand highways, I think we could take some of that money and put it into something like purchasing the CSX rail lines and building regional rail transit. As the caller mentioned, you know, like I'd like to go between Tampa and Sarasota or addressing Cross Bay travel. And we do have a Cross Bay ferry. Like we could look at ferries as well as part of that mix.
The new span of the Howard Franklin is being constructed right now. And there is my understanding is that there's the capacity there for rail. There's no plan in place right now or no funding for it, but it could happen. There could eventually be some sort of rail connecting Pinellas and Hillsborough.
My understanding is they're over-engineering some of those bridge spans to be able to hold tracks in the future. But that could just as easily be two more lanes or four more lanes. So there's no regulatory plan or, you know, piece of legislation that says it has to be rail. So, you know, yes, they're building it to rail standards or heavier vehicle standards, but there's nothing that says it couldn't be converted to car or bus or something else.
Our guests are Josh Frank, an urban designer, and Michelle Cookson with the group Sunshine Citizens. We're talking about transportation here on Tuesday Cafe. I'm Sean Canaan. You're listening to WMNF Tampa, 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. It's 10:40 in the morning. So, Josh, one of the things that you're most famous for is this plan called Boulevard Tampa, and we've heard about it throughout this program, but why don't we spend a little bit of time talking right now about what is Boulevard Tampa? What are the chances that it might actually happen? And where would it be? And why do you support it?
So the very brief recap is essentially the part of 275 from downtown, where Malfunction Junction is, to where 275 connects to 75 up in sort of the preserve area north of USF. That stretch between there is a redundant piece of interstate. It has the same exits as 75. It goes the same places as 75. The time difference is negligible. It's like 2 to 3 minutes. The biggest difference is there's no more room for that interstate to grow. You've seen a lot of pushback from Seminole Heights, Tampa Heights, Ybor City about the expansion of that interstate for good reason. It can't be done without taking more property and displacing more, you know, people of color and homes and businesses. So, you know, FDOT knows this. They've admitted as such. Their initial plans to expand it showed a lot of property being taken. So rather than continue to repeat those same mistakes, the Boulevard project is essentially, let's start now thinking about a future without that segment of interstate. So, you know, it's not necessarily a we're ready to go out there and tear it out tomorrow and have a boulevard and mass transit in its place and that will solve everything. I think it will go a long way, but we have a lot of other things to sort out before we get to that point. So the Boulevard project, in the long and short of it, is it's a conversation about setting that vision. Because for a long time, we've just sort of accommodated that expansion because there's no bigger end game. For me, the Boulevard is that end game. It's where we want to be in 50 years, in 20 years, however long it may take to actually take that interstate, reduce the amount of trips that are on it, and then replace it with something that's way better for not only folks driving from Pasco County, but from folks driving from, you know, East Tampa to West Tampa. So that is sort of the Boulevard in a nutshell. It's taking the interstate out, replacing it with 4 or 6 lanes of traffic. So you're taking 6 lanes out, replacing it with 6 lanes. And also mass transit, bikeability, walkability, smarter land use around each intersection, each station area, to do all of those things that we've already talked about. And then, you know, the feasibility of it is something that's, you know, I think long-term. These projects tend to move very slowly, but I think as long as we know that that's where we want to be and can agree on that, we can work towards that. So that, you know, 275 carries 200,000 cars a day today, but, you know, in 20 years, if we get that down significantly to 100,000, 50,000, 60,000 cars a day, if we can do that, then the decision becomes very easy. We saw during the pandemic, if one of the only benefits is that congestion went down, and the reason it went down is because there were less cars on the road. Now, unfortunately, that meant folks could go faster, and so we saw crashes and fatalities rise as a result. But we know that it's possible with remote working, with smarter land use, with staggering start times for businesses, with all of these different things to get to the point where we've got enough roads and to meet our needs, and we can do a lot better with the way we design our city. So that's sort of the big pitch for the Boulevard.
And it's a proven concept. It's already happening in other places in this country today. So it's not just, oh, that happens in Europe or other parts of the world. That's happening in this country today, where people are looking at these 1960s interstate highways that caused so much harm, that were racist by design. They're reaching the end of their lifespan. And why would we keep putting billions of dollars into them? And they're replacing them with better ways of using that land and enhancing people's lives and reconnecting neighborhoods and boosting communities. So we not only need to push forward with the feasibility study for Boulevard Tampa, it needs to happen like yesterday. There needs to be no more excuses from the Transportation Planning Organization or our elected officials. Like, they need to be talking about this right now. There is more money that's going to become available from the federal government. So all of the excuses that we've heard in the past, they just, you know, they don't hold water. Like, it's time. It's been time. We need to study it. We need to start putting that vision forward of how we want to grow and how we want our future to be. Not just for us, but for future generations.
We have an amazing opportunity in that people want to live here, and they're moving here in great numbers. And we continue to let that opportunity sort of dissipate into growth in South County that not only is unsustainable from an environmental standpoint, but economically costs Hillsborough County residents more money to have folks develop and live and commute and be serviced by fire and EMS and school and all of these other issues that we hear about on the radio all the time. All of those issues have a root in how we design our city and our community. And so we have an opportunity to leverage that growth in a way that not only brings the budget back into a really healthy sort of level of investment, but also to begin to then take the profit that we can generate and reinvest it back in some of those communities that have been harmed by interstates and by urban renewal and all of these things that, you know, as was mentioned in the LA Times again, is not something that's in the distant past. It happened when the interstate was expanded in the 90s. It's going to happen again with this expansion, you know, coming up where there's more displacement. So it's something that is just a radical change in perspective that needs to happen, or else we're unfortunately going to follow the likes of an Atlanta or an LA where we're looking at, you know, freeways that are congested at all times during the day. If there's one lesson to take away from all of this, it's that the only solution to congestion is less cars on the road.
And this is that moment. Like, we are the metro in this state that can get this done. Places like Miami and Orlando, it's too late for them, honestly. Like, they've allowed things like I-4 Ultimate to happen. But the Tampa-St. Pete area, we have this moment. The LA Times coverage was expansive, extensive, and really important. There's a national spotlight on us. And this is our moment where we can step forward and do better.
And maybe on a smaller scale than the Tampa Boulevard idea, I'm going to talk right now about something that's happening in a federal grant that's coming to Tampa right now. This month, Congressmember Kathy Castor announced that the Florida Department of Transportation received a grant from the Biden administration for what's called the Tampa Heights Mobility Corridor. It's an $18 million RAISE grant. That RAISE stands for Rebuilding American Infrastructure with Sustainability and Equity. And the funding assists the city of Tampa in its Complete Streets initiative, leading to more jobs and boosting local businesses. So we'll talk more in a second about what all that means, but let's hear yesterday Representative Castor, Congressmember Castor, gave a press conference in the rain. You'll hear a little bit of rain in Tampa Heights about what this could mean for the community. Here's Representative Castor.
We're all coming together this morning to celebrate investment here in the Tampa Bay area. Last Monday, I was at the White House with President Biden as he signed the Bipartisan Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act into law. It was a hard-fought legislative achievement to get to the most historic investment in our infrastructure across America in history. And we want to explain over the coming weeks what that means to businesses, families, all of us here in the Tampa Bay area. And the RAISE grant that we announced last week is a very good example. The RAISE grant we announced will bring $18 million from the Department of Transportation here to Tampa to help make our streets safer. We all understand that Tampa is growing by leaps and bounds, but in order to keep it special, in order to make sure our streets are safer, and in order to get people out of their cars, we've got to invest in connecting neighborhoods. And what I'm hearing from local neighbors is that then they will bring their dollars into opening small businesses along the corridor. I'm hearing from neighbors that they'll be able to get out and walk to see their families and friends without fear of being run down on Florida Avenue or Nebraska Avenue. But this is a great example of what infrastructure investment in our community will mean over the coming years. This builds upon another grant that we announced last year just across the way, the BUILD grant, that will help extend the Riverwalk and connect neighborhoods on the western side of the Hillsborough River. The Riverwalk now, with that DOT federal grant, will help connect this. Now, with the RAISE grant, the Tampa Complete Streets, Tampa Heights Mobility Corridor, it will come up on this side of the Hillsborough River, and then eventually we'll be able to complete the streets and make those safer connections east to west, and then begin to connect all the way from Ybor over into West Tampa to make this a more livable city as people continue to move here. The other part of the Build Back Better agenda will bring more investment to this community and target neighborhoods that often have been left behind, that don't get the sidewalk repairs that local communities haven't been able to afford. They haven't been able to do the bus lanes, the transit investments. And everyone knows around here, we have got to improve transit if we're going to improve our way of life. There was a USF College of Business study a couple of years ago that said if we can invest more dollars into transit and connect people to their jobs, get them to work safely, get them to school safely, and then back home, we'll be able to lift people out of poverty. So this is a win-win-win for the Tampa Bay area, especially this wonderful Tampa community that I love. So, Commissioner Overman, you have been such a champion for good housing, for transit, for connecting our neighborhoods. Right,
well, she's introducing Commissioner Overman here. We can come back to hear from her in just a minute if we decide to. But I'm going to ask my guests, who I will remind you are Michelle Cookson, a board member and founder of the group Sunshine Citizens, and Josh Frank, an urban designer who is recognized for the plan called Boulevard Tampa. What can you say about the Tampa Heights Mobility Corridor, this $18 million raise grant, and how it kind of sets the stage for the kinds of improvements that you've been talking about?
It is an absolute great project to have come to this city. It's going to do things that we have been asking for a long time, and are all things that we've talked about today. I think you heard a lot of what Congresswoman Castor talked about reconnecting communities. She talked about how getting folks out of their cars means everything from new businesses, small businesses, the street level activity. It's all things that are related to infrastructure. But one of the things that, you know, I think we as citizens need to recognize is that grant was $18 million. The West Shore Interchange costs $1.2 billion. That's 2%. So, you know, and the West Shore Interchange is one of three state-funded projects that we've had in the last couple of years announced. So it's a drop in the bucket. It's a great project. I am looking forward to it. I support it 100%. But it's such a small amount compared to how much we're investing into highways and other modes that, you know, it's almost counterproductive at this point, at that scale, at that ratio. Because when you expand interstates, when you add capacity, when you make, you know, these huge investments in our roadways, you are not just making things easier for the folks who use them. You're doing that for a short period of time, but you're incentivizing further use of those corridors. It's called induced demand. So it's, if you build it, they will come. So essentially, if I've got four lanes, I expand it to six lanes, everybody thinks that it's faster. That's great for a short period of time, but now more people are wanting to use it because it's perceived as faster. It then fills up, and we have to repeat that process over and over and over again. That's how the Katy Freeway in Houston, Texas got to be 23 lanes wide. And not only that, it filled up faster than they originally projected it was going to be, with all of the negative things that come along with interstate expansion and you know, increased car usage. So, you know, my biggest takeaway from that is it's a great, great, great project. We need to do it at a scale at which we're doing highway infrastructure and investment, not only here in Tampa, but I would say federally, it's of that level of importance, because it's the only chance we have to combat climate change. Vehicle, you know, miles traveled and emissions, if you look at the percentage of, you know, emissions coming from the United States, number one, transportation. So the only way to reduce that is to reduce the number of cars on the road. And so we need to treat it as almost an interstate, you know, interstate level of investment in walking, biking, and transit. So that includes buses and ferries and all that sort of stuff. But until we do that, we're really nibbling at the margins, which is unfortunate. I think there's a huge demand. I'm a millennial. I think there's a huge demand from millennials and retiring boomers. Maybe the only thing we can agree on is that we want to live in walkable places that are safe. They just want to do it in the villages. I want to do it in downtown Tampa. So that's fine. But, you know, that is something that I think is not only popular, but it's something that people can really get behind. And I'm really glad we have Congresswoman Castor in office, because I think she understands it.
And so part of what this plan would be widening sidewalks, creating two-way bicycle paths, making a dedicated rapid bus lane between USF and downtown. So, you know, maybe 8-10 years ago, they came up with this Metro Rapid, I think it was called, bus lane that was supposed to be this
Nebraska.
Along Nebraska Avenue, yeah. That was supposed to connect USF area to downtown Tampa. And I don't mean to be a skeptic or anything, but it just seems like it just looks like all the other HART buses with, you know, two or three or four passengers on it.
Yep.
And we were told that it would come every few minutes, and then it would change the lights. You could fly, you know, the buses could fly through the green lights because of the technology on there.
Well, it was designed to do that. However, FDOT never gave HART, the light prioritization.
Right.
So they have two signals that they can actually have that. Now, I've since learned that DOT is going to be investing in ITS and some other thing that's coming up where they're going to be spending a lot of money to improve signals and stuff around the area. And that's one of the things that FDOT has promised, is that we're going to actually finally give Metro Rapid its signal prioritization. But you're right. It was oversold and underdelivered, and it essentially is, the 400 is similar to any other bus route. It's not rapid. It's also not given its own lane. And on Nebraska, room is really tight, so it has to weave in and out. It has to stop traffic, you know. So it's not truly BRT, whereas what's happening on Florida Ave, it sounds like, with that dedicated lane and the signal prioritization, hopefully, is going to be better.
But you have to stay on top of it. For people listening, you've got to contact your county commissioners. And, for example, with the BRT lane, I'll be watching it because there's a segment, again, this is being driven by FDOT, where they're intervening instead of the city leading this because they control Florida Avenue. And from the river to Hillsborough Avenue, they're saying, oh, we won't have a dedicated lane for that bus. And I'm like, that's ridiculous. Like, run this line like you ought to, and don't overpromise and underdeliver. And I just feel locally we should have the ability and authority to say, no, this is how this will be run. I mean, we're going to pay for it. It's a HART bus line, right? So we've got to keep on top of this. We have to stay engaged and involved, and keep contacting our elected officials and saying, this is the priority we want to see. Just the same way this country, like, put so much effort into building these interstate highways, we ought to have a priority in that kind of initiative now to be putting transit first, which is ultimately about people, right? Like, we need to go into the future in a way that's going to be less impactful, that helps us address climate change. And it's got to be that prioritization first. And we can do that. We can invest in that. But we've got to keep pushing them, because all the signals from the state are, they're not interested in that. So,
speaking of dedicated bus lanes, we have someone who emailed in from regarding St. Petersburg and their new dedicated bus lanes. Can anyone explain why First Avenue North and South are being converted to rapid transit without allowing for increased mixed-use residential development, specifically at 34th, 49th, and 58th Street? Why can't developers build 10 to 20-story buildings within five-block radius of these intersections? Who does Pinellas County and the city of St. Pete expect to ride the new buses and ride along the bike lanes? So for people who aren't that familiar with the First Avenue North and South corridors, Sunrunner, and what's happening there.
Yeah, the Sunrunner. I don't know the exact conditions as to those specific intersections, but I do know that the city of St. Pete knows that, you know, transit-oriented development, or TOD, is something that's really important to the Sunrunner. And I would expect, you know, that the density and the height and all that stuff is something that needs to be negotiated with the community members that live there now. And so I know that that process has taken place, or is either going to take place, or, you know, will take place.
Here's another question from David. I'm glad to see there will be a bike pedestrian lane on the new Howard Franklin Bridge. I think it will be well used and a great asset to the community. How do we get a similar bike and pedestrian lanes on the Sunshine Skyway Bridge? Wow, he's ambitious. And on the Gandy Bridge? Well, there is a bike lane associated with the Gandy Bridge.
Well, and the Friendship Trail was supposed to be, the original Gandy Bridge was supposed to be converted to a dedicated bike and ped facility, but was also, you know, not implemented because, well, our lovely friends at FDOT decided the bridge was no longer structurally sound, so they took it out. And, you know, that, as Michelle mentioned, and just my last sentiment here, is that perspective of putting cars first is something that we've done for so long with no return. And if anything from the Boulevard Project, I think we need to flip that into, let's move more people more equitably, more sustainably, and worry about cars second. They will have room to move. They will have lanes. People can still drive. We're not talking about converting to an entirely walk and bike city. But we need to start setting some goals in order to get to the place we all know we want to be.
Any last thoughts, Michelle?
Just agree 100% with what Josh said. Yeah, and just, I guess last thoughts are just going to re-echo what I said before. We really need everyone else to be engaged and contact their county commissioners, their city council members, their state legislators. We need more help from the state, possibly just replace the people that are there, because we have to act on this now. Like, it can't wait. It's great to talk about it. I could talk about it for hours. I appreciate the time talking about it today, but we need people to take action. We need them to really push those in power to make that the priority, like Josh talked about.
Infrastructure is not just roads and bridges.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Michelle and Josh. Thanks for coming on the Tuesday Cafe.
Thank you.
Michelle Cookson is a board member with and founder of the group Sunshine Citizens. Josh Frank is an urban designer recognized for the plan called Boulevard Tampa. You're listening to WMNF Tampa. Thanks to Lamar Robinson for answering our phones. And here's what I have on tap for next Tuesday at 10 in the morning. One guest will be a filmmaker whose documentary points out systemic solutions that address the racial inequity for Black and Native Americans in this country. And I'll also introduce you to WMNF's new reporter, Ariel Stevenson. For many longtime listeners, it will be a reintroduction. It'll also be Giving Tuesday next week. Well, coming up next is the latest issue of Background Briefing. Janelle is out. Thanks so much for listening to WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota.